Welcome to the Natural Selection Presents Extinctions. Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of the Natural Selection Presents. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order, we have me, I am Nick, hello, and we have Naomi.
Hello.
We are still without other Nick, so it'll just be us two in the studio this week. So I'll start with you, Naomi. How's your week been? Have you seen anything cool? Any nice animals? Any horrible animals?
I haven't really. Well, I have in the sense that there are a lot of animals around that I do see all the time, but nothing that has been an unusual encounter this week. Although I do have a lot of fruit flies in the kitchen, which is very annoying, so that's not great. And also I spotted a moth last night, but other than that, not a huge amount. I did get a lovely picture sent to me by my mother of some butterflies that she spotted on her mint plants at home, so that was pretty cool, but I haven't seen too many myself. What about you? Have you seen anything exciting or out of the ordinary?
Yes. I was walking past a tree. The problem with liking insects is it often makes you look insane. Because I was walking past a tree in Neukölln, which is not necessarily a place you want to be caught loitering. But as I walked past it, I realized it was absolutely covered in hundreds of these black and red shield bugs. And it made me realize how long we've been doing this podcast. Because I remember at this time last year, we also spoke about those black and red shield bugs that I watched sort of wander about while I was on a bench. And I still yet to identify them. But I did find them what they were once, and I've forgotten. But they were absolutely all over this tree. So I sort of stood and watched them for a while, but none of them were moving. They were just silently sitting on this tree in Neukölln, chilling.
Interesting.
Yeah, sort of a weird massing behaviour it looks like. So yeah, we'll see why.
Yeah, I was wondering, I was just about to ask that. I wonder if it's some sort of like anti-predator behaviour to try and just like a mass effect, I guess.
I assume they were poisonous because they were red and black, but I don't know why I thought that.
Oh yeah, well, that makes sense, I guess. That's something that's common. Although there are some species that will try to trick you, and they're not poisonous. Although actually, and as well, your comment when you were saying that liking insects makes you look crazy, I think liking animals in any, like particularly if you're in a city and you stop to look at an animal, people will still think you're... Because I did that the last day. I was like peering into a hedge to try and identify a bird, and I definitely got some funny looks.
Well, I'm glad I'm not alone on that one then.
Yeah, and I kind of wanted to like stop people and be like, can you hear this bird? Do you know what it is? But I decided against it.
Yeah, because if they can't hear the bird, that won't help you.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Well, I guess we'll get on with the news. Interestingly, we had quite similar news this week, but about very different animals. So I'm going to be talking about octopuses, specifically the common Sydney octopus, or Octopus tetricus. And the reason I'm talking about this one is there's a researcher, Peter Godfrey Smith, at the University of Sydney, which seems an apt university to find the common Sydney octopus, has observed behaviour which he believes is showing octopuses deliberately throwing things at each other. So there's a part of the sea near Sydney in Jervis Bay, and it's dubbed Octopolis. And the reason for this is it's one of the few places in this area where octopuses can make dens. And because of this, because the sea can support a lot of octopuses, but their dens have to be in a certain place, there's actually an unusually large number of octopuses concentrated in this small area. A bit like human cities, when you get a lot of people close together, this can cause some aggravation and some tense sort of interactions. And what they observed is female octopuses throwing things at males. And they think it might be deliberately to sort of put them off mating when it's someone undesirable that they don't want to mate with, to sort of say steer clear. So there was two sort of ways they threw things. One of them was that they sometimes threw shells, and most of the time they threw silt, was what they were actually doing was sort of blowing it up in the air. They were sort of shot between the front two tentacles, they would fling it at the other octopus, and they became convinced it was deliberate because they noticed that one time a female octopus attempted 10 throws and 5 of them hit a male. So she was rocking about a 50% percentage hit rate. You know, that's not bad. On one occasion, they observed an octopus throw a shell and hit an octopus by flinging it like a frisbee. So, yeah, this could be an interesting behaviour that's evolved to sort of, yeah, prevent unwanted behaviour from frisky octopuses.
Wow, interesting. Good. You go, female octopuses.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. There is video as well, which you can find if you Google, Peter Godfrey Smith and octopuses. You'll find a very amazing video of octopuses flinging things at each other.
Cool. I was trying to think of where I recognized that name, and I realized it's because he's the author of Other Minds, which is about animal intelligence. I haven't actually read it yet, but it is in my to-read list.
Okay, well, let us know.
I will do.
But I believe your news is also about, I think, annoyed animals is the best way to put this.
Yes, yeah. It's shocking how similar our news was this week. Kind of weirdly similar in a way, because it feels like it's a very uncommon topic to have research about. I was even surprised I found this piece. So this piece was published in Current Biology, and it was led by a researcher from the Cornell University and the Cornell Ornithology Lab. And it was looking at female hummingbirds. And it was looking particularly at this species of hummingbird called the white-necked Jacobin hummingbird. And so the males of this species have bright blue heads and throats, and generally the females are drab. However, some of these females actually are bright blue. They have the same coloration as the males. And the animals actually start off bright blue. This is their juvenile coloration. And then the females become kind of an olive, more dull color, and the males retain the blue. But they found that actually they looked at about 400 birds, which they captured and released in Panama. And most of the females were this olive green color, but about 30% of them stayed blue. And they were wondering why. So what they did was they got taxidermied birds, and they had one that was a drab female. I feel kind of bad using that phrasing, but anyway, that's what they used in the research. One was a drab female and the other was the brightly colored female. And what they found was that they wanted to see how live birds react to these stuffed dummies. They found that the males tended to prefer the drab looking females, and they would sometimes perform their swooping dives. And also the males attempted to mate with them more frequently. In addition, not only this, but they also were attacked more, not only by males, but also by females and other species. And apparently the researcher said that white-necked Jacobins can actually be very aggressive. He said, personality-wise, they're like the show-off jocks of the hummingbird world. So these dull green females were getting attacked a lot more than their brightly colored females. And like I said, it didn't only come from the males, but also other species and females as well. And on top of that, what they did was that they put in tracking tags onto these wild birds, and they looked at how long the birds were able to stay at feeders. And they found that the drab females stayed at feeders much shorter than the bright blue colored ones. So it suggests that being this blue color allows the females to stay undisturbed at these feeders longer so they can eat better. So I thought there was many layers to this. I had a bit of a roller coaster reading it. I was very frustrated for these poor hummingbirds who just want to eat without getting harassed. But it's really fascinating. So yeah, at the moment I think it's 30%, but I was wondering, you know, will this percentage change if it's beneficial for them to, because particularly for hummingbirds, they need a lot of nutrients because they have an exceptionally high metabolism. They need a lot of food. So this feels like something that would be of advantage to them, and they're able to eat for longer. So yeah, I thought it was an interesting one.
I suppose, yeah, thinking about it though, that if they have reduced male attention, there probably is a reduced level of mating, so maybe it balances out, and that's why.
Potentially, yeah. I don't know if it was because it wasn't actually mating season, but even though there was like a couple of instances of the sexual advances, there wasn't any actual matings. So they didn't really specifically look at that in this paper, but yeah, potentially that could be the case. But and they must still be able to pass it on if they're still surviving. So yeah, maybe it is a balance.
Interesting. Yeah, I like a hummingbird. Never seen one.
Yeah, me neither.
One day. I hope you see one of the drab ones.
Thanks. Me too. Although potentially harder to see, so.
Yeah, true. And yeah, they won't even stay at your feeders, so.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that does bring us to the end of the news. So I guess we'll be back after this short break to talk about our theme this week, which is extinctions. Welcome back, listeners, after that short break. We are back again, which, unlike so many animals which disappear, to never return, because we are here to talk about extinctions. I suppose, yeah, this is one of those parts of life that is often seen as quite depressing nowadays, because extinction in the news is usually caused by humans. Whereas, yeah, I suppose historically that's not always been the case, and extinctions have always been a part of the renewal of life.
Yeah, true. Yeah, there's been five mass extinctions? Or is it six?
I think we're currently in one, which would be the sixth.
Okay.
But they're quite hard to track, I believe. But yeah, I suppose without these extinctions, we wouldn't be here today. So, yeah, swings and roundabouts, I guess. Without the death of the dinosaurs, there'd be no natural selection podcast. So it's not all bad. I'm sure some of you will agree with that. But yeah, I thought I'd start us off this week, because you mentioned the five mass extinctions. I wanted to talk about the earliest one, and that is the Ordovician-Silurian extinction events. This was intriguing to me, because event had an S on the end, which means there's more than one. So the Ordovician and Silurian were these time periods, and the extinction events took place on the border between the two. It was sort of like the dividing line. So generally, a lot of what died was what existed in the Ordovician. So what was the Ordovician? And it's the period of time that immediately follows the Cambrian. So I imagine a lot of people have heard of the Cambrian explosion, which is when a lot of life sort of came into being. But not many people have heard of the Ordovician radiation. And that's fair. I mean, radiators don't sound quite as exciting as explosions. But yeah, they are really, really important. And while all of the animal phyla that exist today had evolved by the end of the Cambrian, and that's not quite true because there's one that didn't. So I'm going to test you on that at the end. So to explain phylum, so a phylum would be chordates or vertebrates or sponges or echinoderms, the starfish. So that is a phylum. So they're a very, very large grouping. But what happened during the Ordovician is that these separate phylums got filled with their own diversity. So sort of the ends of the branches of the tree of life began to expand rather than the base. Obviously a really, really important time. So yeah, a little quiz before we get going. Do you know which is the one animal phyla which had never been found till after the Cambrian?
Oh, one animal phyla. I don't know off the top of my head. I'm trying to make a guess. Is it Ctenophore?
Oh, unlucky. No, it's the Bryozoans.
Ah. Oh, interesting. Okay. I would have guessed that.
So that's not to say they didn't evolve in the Cambrian, but the first fossils we've ever found are post-Cambrian, and they're the only animal phyla where this is the case. So really, really interesting separation there, which I didn't know either. So what is this extinction? It was two events which occurred that killed off 27% of all families on Earth, 57% of all genera, and about 60 to 70% of all species. So you can see, yeah, it's killing off a lot of species and even a quarter of all families. So to give you an idea of what a family is, our family is the great apes. So if our family died out, that would be every single great ape going extinct at once. You think of the diversity of mammals, there are 153 families existing in mammals. If 27% of them died, yeah, it'd be over 30 families of animals, which include all deers maybe, or all squirrels, all disappearing at once, all canines, all felids, they would all disappear. It'd be a big, big deal. And it appeared to affect marine genera even more harshly. So up to 60% of marine genera and 85% of marine species could have died out. So absolutely massive. So why did this happen? So there's a few theories on why this happened, and it's such a long time ago. We're talking like over 400 million years ago. So the first one is rapid cooling and glaciation. This, interestingly, could be caused by the evolution of plants. This is around the time in the Ordovician when non-vascular plants, things like mosses, have made it onto planet Earth. And not only would they absorb CO2, which would help cool the Earth because they're photosynthesizing, they also take part in the breakdown of rocks to produce silicates. And these silicates also absorb CO2 from the atmosphere, helping with that cooling process. And over millions and millions of years of these mosses covering the Earth, this could have been enough to reduce the level of CO2 to cause glaciation, which is the proposed first step of the Ordovician-Silurian extinction event. Alternatively, Gondwana also drifted over the South Pole, which helped create glaciation on land, evidence of which has been found in both Africa and America in places you wouldn't normally think of glaciers existing. But yeah, we found evidence in places like Morocco. So that was the first step. This was followed, they think, by rapid warming. So towards the very end of the Ordovician, rapid warming occurred, and this is thought to be caused by increased volcanic activity releasing greenhouse gases. This in turn triggered anoxia in the oceans, because warm water holds less oxygen, which might explain why the extinction was so much more profound in the seas rather than on land, because simply, yeah, it was affecting the seas more with this loss of oxygen. But there are some alternative theories. While this has historically been the case, it's really, really debated this. One of them is toxic metals in the ocean. And this could be caused because there's less oxygen in the water, it gives them a chance to dissolve something else. And some scientists have come to the conclusion that they may have dissolved toxic metals, things like lead, which naturally lie on the ocean floor. And they did this by looking at fossils from this time. And one, they found an increased level of toxic metals in the minerals around there. But also, they seem to mimic what happens when modern animals get toxic metal poisoning. So perhaps this could have been a driver as well. And again, it's a marine thing, so it explains the levels in marine death. Now, slightly out there theory, which is harder to prove, but one researcher suggested that it could have been caused by a gamma ray burst originating from a hypernova nearby. And it could be about 6,000 light years from Earth. But they're saying a 10-second burst would have stripped the Earth's atmosphere of half its ozone almost immediately. And that would mean that all surface-dwelling organisms, including those responsible for planetary photosynthesis, to high levels of ultraviolet radiation. This would have meant that most of the things producing photosynthesis on the surface could have been killed almost instantly, causing a massive rise in CO2, which could lead to, yeah, the global warming, which triggered this extinction event. So it was an important one. A lot of the ones affected was there was a huge drop in the number of trilobites. Trilobites were heavily affected, but it was also sort of the what we would consider like plankton now. Sort of those free living tiny things in the ocean that sort of floated about. They were super, super affected and obviously a really, really important part of the food chain. So yeah, a really, really massive extinction event that happened over 400 million years ago.
Cool. That's really interesting. Yeah, there was some of those ideas were things I hadn't really heard of before. The gamma ray one was interesting.
And it was a big one. It was the second largest extinction event in Earth's history, but not to be outdone, Naomi.
Yeah, I decided to talk about the biggest extinction event. So the one I wanted to talk about was the End Permian extinction, or the Great Dying, as it's known colloquially. So this is the boundary between the Permian and the Triassic period. And so I wanted to get a little bit more literary with it, perhaps, than your very scientific explanation of the of some of the causes of the extinction. So I wanted to talk about, and a lot of the source for this is from a book called The Rise and Fall of Dinosaurs, published by Steve Brissette. And this chapter in particular is looking at the outset before dinosaurs came on the scene. So dinosaurs came about in the Triassic, or they became more common and began to become dominant in the Triassic. So laying the scene, about 252 million years ago, the world began to change. So if I can get you guys to imagine, you're standing on a riverbank. Now, it doesn't look quite like a riverbank you might imagine, but it's not incredibly dissimilar. You see coniferous trees, large peaked mountains, but the animals would be kind of different, and also would be incredibly hot and humid. So some of the animals you may see, and I'll read a brief excerpt from the book, because I think he lays it out quite nicely, and it's all sorts of animals flocked to these rivers, but they weren't animals we would know. There were slimy salamanders, bigger than dogs, loitering near the water's edge and occasionally snapping at a passing fish. Stocky beasts called pariosaurs waddled around on all fours, their knobby skin, front heavy build, and general brutish appearance, making them seem like a mad reptilian offensive lineman. Fat little things called diconodonts rummaged around in the muck like pigs, using their sharp tusks to pry up tasty roots. Lording over it all were the Gorgonospians, bear-sized monsters who reigned at the top of the food chain, slicing into pariosaur guts and diconodont flesh with their saber-like canines. The cast of all oddballs ruled the world right before the dinosaurs. So as I mentioned, there are some of the animals that are very nicely described, I feel, that you might see. So we've got synapsids, which used to be known as mammal-like reptiles, but it's not really in favor anymore. It's kind of not very thought to be very scientific anymore, which includes the diconodonts. And these were really successful during the Permian. Again, the Gorgonospians, they were quite successful, and they would have been kind of the top of the food chain. And so there are many theories as to what happened that caused this mass extinction event, but I'm going to focus on one that I think is thought to be the most scientifically favored, but of course there are others, and it is one of those things that it's quite difficult to know, but this is what some of the evidence points towards, and also I think it makes a very dramatic picture. Imagine you're standing by this river, Grank, and the world begins to rumble. You may not feel it at this point, but way down below the Earth's surface, magma is beginning to move, and eventually it'll make its way to this hot liquid rock will make its way to the surface, and it'll break free, and it will erupt in hot spots, and this would have been under Siberia, and it wouldn't really have been in volcanoes like we may imagine now, like cone-shaped volcanoes. Basically, the Earth would have opened up, and lakes of lava would have poured from it. And this is really bad news for the diconodonts, the Gorgonospians that are right there in Siberia. They wouldn't have lasted very long. But volcanoes don't just emit lava. There's other things that come out of them, and this is where the real bad news happens for the rest of the planet. So we would have had dust, heat, and gas being emitted, and so this would have affected air currents, and then also these massive clouds of dust would have blocked out the sun, which would have affected photosynthesis, and there's evidence that a lot of the trees died. And also there's a boundary of fungi that can be seen in these rocks. This exploding population of fungi suggests that there is a huge mass of dead trees available for them to feast on. As a result, the pariosaurs and the diconodonts would have had no plants to eat, and therefore the terrifying Gorgonospians wouldn't have had any meat to eat either. So all of these food chains would have collapsed. On top of this, you would have had acid rain. Again, not great for any plants that are managing to hang on. On top of this, because you have no plants, you're also getting huge amounts of erosion. And so you can see this in some of the rocks, because you go from kind of these fine mudstones to these of rock that have much bigger chunks in them. And then you're also getting wildfires to make matters worse. And then those are just the short-term effects. On top of that, you get a huge amount of CO2 being emitted. And the CO2, which is a greenhouse gas, as we're very well aware of now, and this would have caused a runaway greenhouse effect. So it would have heated up the Earth to extreme temperatures and would have caused lots of knock-on effects. One of such knock-on effects is because there was so much CO2, a lot of it went into the ocean, and this would have made it more acidic, which is bad for creatures that have shells, and those shells can easily dissolve in acid. And also, you're removing the oxygen from the water because there's a lot of CO2 in it, which isn't great for anything really that needs to live in the water. As well as that, there would have been sea level changes from the heating up the planet and changing the sea levels. But about 90% of all animals went extinct. Some notable mentions would be trilobite, tabulate, and rugose corals. Some things that didn't go entirely extinct but did definitely suffer great losses would have been crinoids, brachiopods, shelled cephalopods. And because Nick mentioned, and I'm also going to do a bit of a breakdown in the amounts of families that went extinct, so 57% of biological families, 83% of genera, and 81% of marine species went extinct in this extinction. But yeah, 90% of life went extinct at that point. So it was a pretty big one. But it laid the scene for the dinosaurs to eventually dominate and then mammals to come onto the scene as well.
Yeah, the Great Dying. I mean, at least they got a cool name out of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it was only the Permian extinction, not the permanent extinction, which would have been much worse.
Yes, yeah. Well, we wouldn't be here talking about it, certainly.
Yeah. I suppose, yeah, it's interesting to think that, because these extinctions, so many things died, and we can see that by the fossil record. But it's actually quite a low number of fossils which really survived. So we're only actually seeing like a tiny little snapshot of the things that were alive. So there were some things that lived and died without us ever knowing. In fact, most things, I believe, lived and died without us ever knowing, which means that when we find a really, really cool animal, it's quite lucky. So I wanted to talk about an extinct animal, which some people might be glad is extinct. This is called the Titanoboa. And the Titanoboa was a snake. It was a boid. Makes sense, right, with its name? Give you an idea of why it's got the name Titan. The longest current snake is a reticulated python, which is regularly about 6.25 meters in length. The Titanoboa was over twice as long at 12.8 meters. So long. The world's heaviest snake is the green anaconda. The problem with the green anaconda is there's a lot of, you know, those videos you see of like shaky cameras in the Amazon where they're sort of saying, look how big this snake is. But the highest verifiable weight of a green anaconda is 97.5 kilograms. Titanoboa was 1,135 kilograms. So it was over a ton of snake. Yeah, insane.
That's too much snake.
It is a lot of snake, I'm not going to lie. They lived in northeastern Colombia, and as far as we have found, they are the largest snake which has ever lived. Now, looking at them, experts think they are most closely related to the boidae that live in places like Madagascar and the Pacific Islands. Yeah, not really the snakes that you would find in Colombia nowadays, which are apparently quite different. And it seems very, very scary, probably because it is. It's terrifying. But it has some interesting features compared to other boids. And reading this from a study by a professor Head at Cambridge University, within Boanae, so the cranial elements of Titanoboa possess unique features relative to other boids, including, might struggle to explain because I don't fully understand what these are because they're very technical terms about the skull. So feel free to jump in there if you can help. So high palatal and marginal tooth position counts. So as far as I understand, the palate is the top bit of the jaw, and the marginal tooth position counts, all I could really understand was the margins of the tooth were the edges of the tooth. So I'm not really sure what that meant. Low angled quadrate orientation. So this is a bone in tetrapod jaws, and the quadrate bone forms the lower jaw articulation in all classes except the mammals. So it's sort of where the hinge is. And this has a low angled orientation. Reduced palatine, pterygoid, and pterygoid quadrate articulations. Now this sounds really complicated, but these bits are just parts of the jaw and the skull. So the connections between them are the articulations. So they have reduced connections between these parts of the skull. And all these characters are combined with weakly ankylosed teeth. But all this means is the teeth are not anchored strongly. So they're not really very attached to the skull. And looking at characteristics of snakes nowadays, what this would suggest is all these features are found in piscivorous snakes, snakes which eat fish. So this Titanoboa pretty much might not have cared about us because it would have been eating fish all day. So it wouldn't be a problem anyway, because they lived about 60 million years ago. They lived for about 10 million years in that time period. So they never would have bumped into us. But they were swimming around with like giant crocodilians and things like that. So yeah, it would have been quite a terrifying swamp to live in. But the interesting thing, and another good thing about extinct animals, is sometimes they can tell us something about the world of old. So a lot of people have been talking about what a snake this size means for the climate. Because some people say that because the snake is this big, it would require a hotter temperature because they're ectothermic. So they need a warm environment. So to get this big, it needs to be warmer. So people suggest that the tropics would have had to been about 32 degrees centigrade, which is warmer than we think that time was. So maybe it's evidence that it was warmer than we think. And this would, this warmer temperature would allow cold-blooded snakes to get much, much larger. But other researchers disagree because they said using this mathematical model, this would predict that Australian reptiles now would be able to grow up to 10 to 14 meters, which is not the case. So perhaps this mathematical model is not quite accurate. There's something we're not fully understanding. So finally, someone looking at that in another critique, a specialist in biomechanics, noted that the snake was so large, producing so much metabolic heat, that the ambient temperature should actually be colder than our current estimate of the temperatures at those times. Otherwise, the snake would have overheated. So what I really, really like about this is, that this fossil of a giant, terrifying snake that may or may not have eaten fish caused an argument about global climate 60 million years ago. So something I'm glad is extinct, but also, gives us a fascinating insight into the prehistoric world.
Yes, it's really cool.
But I believe you want to talk about an extinction that is very much not prehistoric.
Yes, so I actually want to talk about an extinction that is actually due to humans, or at least partly due to humans. I want to talk about the passenger pigeon. So the passenger pigeon, Ectopes migratorius, its name means moving about or wandering, and migratorius indicates its migratory habit. And also even the English common name, passenger pigeon, actually comes from the French word passager, I think. I'm sorry for any French people who I've offended with my pronunciation, but which means to pass in a fleeting manner, to pass by in a fleeting manner. So they were nomadic. They tended to constantly move around in search of food, shelter, and nesting grounds. And they were also very fast flyers. So there's estimates that they could reach speeds of 100 kilometers per hour, which is 62 miles per hour. And they tended to feed on mast, which is the seeds or pine cones of trees. And these are produced kind of in cyclical cycles. So there tends to be like a huge amount of them, and then they reduce their numbers the next year or so, and then there's a huge amount of them. So they tend to be kind of a boom-bust cycle with that. They also feed on insects and fruit as well, or invertebrates and fruit as well. So they tended to practice communal roosting and communal breeding, and their extreme gregariousness was linked to kind of an idea that it would help them from predators. So that when predators are searching for food, that predator would be satiated because there'd be so many pigeons that they wouldn't be able to get through all of the pigeons. That's kind of the idea behind their large amounts of birds. I would like to read you, again, very literary this week, I'd like to read you a small excerpt from the 1831 ornithological biography by American naturalist and artist John James Audubon. And he's talking about the migration that he saw in 1813. I dismounted, seated myself on an eminence, and began to mark with my pencil, making a dot for every flock that passed, in a short time finding the task which I had undertaken impracticable. As the birds poured in countless multitudes, I rose and, counting the dots then put down, found that 163 had been made in 21 minutes. I travelled on and still met more the farther I proceeded. The air was literally filled with pigeons. The light of noonday was obscured as by an eclipse. The dung fell in spots, not unlike melting flakes of snow, and the continuous buzz of wings had a tendency to lull my senses to repose. I cannot describe to you the extreme beauty of their aerial evolutions. When a hawk chanced to press upon the rear of the flock, at once, like a torrent, and with a noise like thunder, they rushed into a compact mass, pressing upon each other towards the centre. In these almost solid masses, they darted forward in undulating and angular lines, descended and swept close and over the earth with inconceivable velocity, mounted perpendicular so as to assemble a vast column, and, when high, were seen wheeling and twisting within their continued lines, which then resemble the coins of a gigantic serpent. Before sunset, I reached Louisville, distant from Hardinsburg 55 miles. The pigeons were still massing in undiminished numbers and continued to do so for 3 days in succession. While it's quite a literary example, it gives you an idea of how huge these flocks were. There's lots of different accounts of them basically blocking out the sky by how massive they were. And so there was an estimated population of at least 3 billion birds, which is actually about a third of the population of all kinds of birds in North America today. And unfortunately, by 1900s, there was none in the wild. And in 1914, the last one went extinct in captivity in Cincinnati Zoo. So part of the reason for this was their huge flocks actually kind of were bad when they came up against humans. So one, I think that it kind of did make them almost in a way a pest, because farmers and things feared them coming up against their crops and eating crops and things like that. And in addition, it made them exceptionally easy to hunt because there were so many of them. They could be hunted in numerous ways, and they could be netted. There could be baited traps. They put sulfur underneath roosting trees so the fumes would daze birds. They set roosting trees on fire. They killed them for private consumption, and they also sold them at the market, maybe for as little as 50 cents for a dozen birds. And so in the 1850s, the destruction of these pigeons was in full force. And in 1860, they did notice they were in decline. But at this point, nothing was really happening to stop this. There were in Michigan in 1878, there were 50,000 birds per day killed, and this rate continued for nearly 5 months. And then, you know, conservationists were trying to stop this, and eventually a law was passed in 1897 to call for a closed season on passenger pigeons. But at this point, it was too late. There were some birds in captivity, but the last bird, Martha, her name was, she died in 1914 in Cincinnati Zoo. It was believed that, as well, because of their gregariousness, that they also needed this kind of group flocking for their mating as well. So they kind of had a, or so I've been told, is they believe that they have this lower limit of their population in which they're just not really able to survive anymore. So even though they had a bird or several birds in captivity, they weren't really able to save the population at that point. And interestingly as well, some of the genetic research that has been done on museum specimens suggests that they did have this kind of boom bust in their populations, that this was particularly a large number of passenger pigeons at this time, and generally they wouldn't get so large. And because of the system, it kind of combined with humans, and also the fact that they would have been going through kind of a natural ecological decline in numbers because they had their boom and they were going to go bust, but because humans were there to kind of speed along the process, this didn't help. And kind of an anecdotal thing that I heard when I first learned about the passenger pigeons going extinct, that they were so numerous that they were actually even used and sold for like things like dog food as well, that I think the concept at the time was there were just so many of them that it would be like impossible to drive them to extinction. But that was not the case, and unfortunately the passenger pigeon is extinct.
That's kind of staggering. 3 billion to nil.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I think that was actually the title of one of the articles I read.
Oh really?
Yeah, 3 billion to zero.
I wouldn't even know what to do with 3 billion pigeons.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think that was part of the, well, not the problem. Obviously, the problem was that they were getting hunted with no controls. But I think at that time, people just thought there was just so many that it would be not possible to kind of consume. And I don't think there was this awareness of the fact that things went extinct, or maybe there was, but people just didn't really care. But even though this was obviously bad for the passenger pigeon, this did kind of spur on the idea that animals did go extinct, and kind of the Audubon Society used the passenger pigeon as kind of an example of like, this can happen, we should protect other birds. So
cool. All right then, brilliant, thank you for that, Naomi. Unfortunately, that does bring us to the end of this episode. Like all good living things, sometimes they have to end. But we will be back next week, for which will sadly be, for at least a little while, our final episode. So our next week's theme will be Goodbye for Now, where we'll be picking a selection of our favourite animal and plant facts from all around the world. Yeah, and just things we're passionate about, really. So until next week, from everyone here at The Natural Selection Presents, goodbye.
Bye.
I bet you couldn't cause an argument about global climate 60 million years ago, Naomi, so, and you're alive.
Yeah.